When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another special episode of the Comics Collective, the weekly show where we talk about a comic or graphic novel of our choice, and sometimes we get to talk to some really awesome people who are making some really awesome books. I am your host today, Anne, and I am joined by the amazingly talented writer of an upcoming book that I really think all of you should check out called Loving Ohio. Why did I say Ohio like that? I have no idea. It just it gets stuck in your throat a little bit. You don't want to admit it, but okay. I am here with Matthew Ehrman. Matthew, how are you doing today?
Hi. Yeah, I'm doing great. Thank you, Anne, so much for having me. It's a blast to get to talk about this book and get to talk to you. I haven't done much press like this for Loving Ohio, so this is one of the first things that I've done so far. So it's nice to get back in the swing of things. It's been a while since I've done this stuff.
Heck yeah. That just means I can get all the bad questions out of the way really quickly. And then much smarter
you'll be the first to ask the good questions is how.
Oh, okay. We can focus optimistically. We can do this. Yeah. So Ohio.
Yeah.
That's just it. That's just the question.
That's the whole podcast.
That's the whole podcast. I would love to, cause I'm pretty new to your work. Loving Ohio is the first book of yours I've read, but yeah, it's not the first one someone's told me to read. Can you talk a little bit about where people might know you from and your history with comics so far?
Yeah. So I've been a comic writer since 2017. That was my first series with my wife, Lisa Stirl, called Long Lost through Scout Comics. And that's kind of how I made an entrance into the industry. It was a really very small book. As far as readership, it was 12 issues long. It was a long book, actually. And it's a black and white horror about two sisters that kind of go back to their hometown of Hazel Patch. And the reason why I wanted to start with Long Lost is because there's a pretty consistent through line of home in my work and how that affects good and positive a lot of people. After Long Lost, I did some intellectual property work for Boom and Boombox. I did a Dark Crystal book that I absolutely still love to this day called Journey into the Mondo Leviathan. I did a Power Rangers book, which was pretty cool. Never thought I'd do one of those. Also did a Care Bears book. Again, one of those things. You never think you'd, as a comic writer, you just, you know, when you're trying to make it in the industry, every little job looks like dollar signs. I did IP work right after Long Lost, and then since then I've been almost exclusively creator owned. I've worked with Boom. My original series with Boom was called Good Luck. I have an original series out with Vault. I have two, actually. Vault did Witchblood and Bonding, which were really cool, like, genre pieces. Same with Good Luck. It's a very big sci-fi inspired by Stalker comic. It's like Stalker with kids. I don't really understand why they decided to publish that one, but I'm happy with it. And after all that, I did some work for Mad Cave, which has been great. I did a little comic called Terminal Punks with Shelby Criswell. I loved working with them. One of my favorite people in the whole world to work with. If you're not familiar with their work, I very, very strongly suggest check it out. I think that about wraps it up. I have a comic series out next week called Golgotha Motor Mountain through IDW with me and Lonnie Nadler and Robbie Rodriguez and Marissa Louise and Nicholas Ejima and so many cool artists. And it's a wild book. It's the weirdest thing I've ever written. So I'm excited to see how it does, how it works out. But yeah, that's me.
That's awesome. And we love weird. We also love range, because that's a heck of a range going from Care Bears to Loving Ohio. My head is
Thank you. Yeah,
a lot of whiplash.
I have dipped my toes in pretty much every genre you could possibly conceive of in this industry, for the most part. I've been trying to cross a few others off my list, but yeah, I've done pretty much everything you can do in this industry except for writing superheroes, which at this point in my career almost seems like I'm actively avoiding it. And then my next book, Loving Ohio, is out in August, and that is kind of for me, it feels like a culmination of a lot of the other work I've done in the past that you know, specifically looking at Long Lost, and there are aspects of some of my like short comic work that I've done for indie anthologies that I've kind of go back to and think about as kind of the genesis for Loving Ohio.
Well, I think that's a great segue into if you could very quickly talk about Loving Ohio, introduce the audience who might not have heard about the book, what exactly the book is, what it's about. It's out in August. I got to read it a year before it came out, so I've been sitting on this for a long time, and it blew me away. So please, tell everyone what this book is about.
Loving Ohio is a horror story that it follows. It's about four teens that live in this town, Loving Ohio. It's their senior year of high school, and it is a town pretty much dominated by a bland new age cult called The Chorus. And The Chorus is a part of everyone's lives. They operate businesses. Teachers are a part of it. It's been worked into the fabric of their society. And Loving Ohio starts with one of our friends. One of the friends of the group commits suicide, and that sets off kind of a chain of discovery and mystery and horror that wraps up the four main characters and kind of how they go about processing both their grief for their friend and how the town itself kind of responds to the tragedies that they face over the course of their senior year. I think that's I think that's about it.
Yeah, that's a great summary. I think it's such an interesting book, and I was reading it, and the whole time I'm like, am I biased about this book because I'm from Ohio too, and this is exactly what this feels like. it feels like almost like trapped in a liminal space, but also at the same time there's that sense of familiarity, and it's weird to have that familiarity and that peacefulness along with a sense of dread and just like isolation. So you said that this is one of the best pieces of fiction that you've written so far in your life.
Yeah.
What do you think that you really nailed in this book that you were trying to, better way to phrase it. What do you really think you brought to this book that the other books you've written so far didn't quite capture the same way?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. Thank you. Yeah. I think there are aspects of myself in all the things that I write. And there are things in Witchblood, for instance, that this book would never be able to articulate or capture about kind of how I see the world in a way. With Loving Ohio, more than any other book, and that is and in part thanks to Connor and Dark Horse, it is a real true distillation of how I write. And the story structure is very close to kind of my vision of what this book needed to be. It's not a traditional structure for a story, and I know people get, you know, don't like hearing that so much. But I think, you know, when you look at genre and horror, things kind of tend to fit very neatly into buckets. And one of the things that Loving Ohio and one of the things that I love doing is taking a a horror genre, like a slasher, for instance, I think Loving Ohio has a lot of those tropes, and upending them and making this genre feel new and interesting and not follow the story beats that everyone knows by you know, to death now. Have different moments where the story breaks and have different parts where the story is completely alien and you don't really quite know what is happening or what to expect going forward. Loving Ohio does that better than I really intended, I think. And in part due to Sam's beautiful, beautiful illustrations and colors. Sam Beck is the artist on this book, and she does everything. Letters, colors, the illustrate, like every visual aspect, every visual thing that you see in this book is Sam's. And that is another thing that, you know, I've never experienced, except for the first time I wrote a comic, which was with my wife. Long Lost was very similar. Lisa did everything from top to bottom for the art in that. And it's really incredible and really special to get to return to that kind of very small team where Sam and I are literally making every decision. And it's incredible to work in a large group of people where you have a letterer and a colorist and you know, it's really cool to get to collaborate with a group, but there is something really, really undeniably unique about getting to collaborate with one person, and that and what you put and what gets created is the genesis between just two people, and that's Loving Ohio, and that's why I think I'm so proud of it. I'm so proud of the work that both of that we both did, and I'm the writing. I think it Sam's work helped me elevate my own work. You know, I wanted to be better, and she brought that out of me. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Everything that Sam does in this book is just spellbinding.
I agree.
Especially the way it portrays emotion. And I keep thinking about the part at the beginning where the main character Sloane is talking to her friend who is the one who eventually commits suicide. And just the way that, like, you can feel his emotions flooding off of him like an oil slick on water. I thought that was lovely. The book is beautiful when it needs to be and terrifying when it needs to be too. I can't wait to talk about The Afternoon Man and the chorus, because the scene in the I don't remember if it was a club or if it was
the church basement.
I've been thinking about that one since I read the book. I can't get that out of my head. But before we get there, I want to talk a bit about Sloane and her friends. Sloane is the main character of the book. Mm-hmm. And the emotional heart of it, this is, you know, at its heart, it's a coming of age story. And did you find that was a hard thing to balance, is trying to find that right amount of heart to give it while also keeping that suspenseful horror aspect?
No, I think that's a great question. I think that the thing that I really love to do, and I think we did in this book, is the heart and the drama. There's a scene in particular that I think about that for me that encapsulates the tone of the book, which is, you know, there is a weight of dread and of kind of unknowable unease. And there's a scene where Sloane is reading a poem from Jesse. It's after some stuff happens at the church basement, and they're there to kind of go through their friend's things and find the stuff that they've left at his house and kind of reconcile with some of that stuff. I don't know if anyone has lost a friend, but that's, you know, that happens. They have a lot of things. People have a lot of shit, and you know, sometimes you don't know what to do with all that stuff. So that scene is kind of, I think, the emotional heart of the story where, yeah, Sloane's reading this poem. The poem itself is you know, dark, and there's a deepness to it that's hard to articulate. And the meaning of the poem isn't exactly clear. And the other characters are kind of going through this, their own thing in the scene. And there's a alone, there's an aloneness to that scene. And I think in horror and in coming of age, the sense of loneliness is really palpable. I was a teenager in Ohio and I was very alone. It's very lonely here, especially if you don't feel like you have a good community or a good group of people that you, a good support structure. Mm-hmm. And I think for the characters, loneliness is kind of pervasive throughout this place. It's, you know, you're lonely when you're with friends, even. You're lonely when you're at school. You're lonely when you're at church or whatever you're going to. There's a feeling that, you know, nobody is there with you in that same space. Everyone, you know. And so for me, that is coming of age, and it's also horror, you know. Mm-hmm. Literally, to like, you know, how many horror scenes are about someone being separated or being alone or being, you know, not having a protector or someone to help them, and they are just at the whims of chaos. And that also is Ohio. So
it really fits like a glove. And, you know, it's the meme where it's like the horror of the book is just Ohio itself. But
I didn't know about that meme until after all this. I've been so disconnected from social media, and the book got posted on Reddit and someone mentioned some memes, and I looked in, I had no idea Ohio was a fucking meme. So,
oh yeah, it's great when you're like, oh, the whole state's getting roasted at all times. Like, technically, I don't know what we did to deserve this, but at the same time, I get it. I understand. It tracks. Yeah. But I think that takes, that goes into something else I wanted to talk about, because, you know, saying the book in Ohio, this story is a very personal one. Both in terms of the characters and the plot. I wanted to talk about the characters first. Coming up with Sloane and her group of friends, did you pull a lot from your own lived experience to kind of flesh them out? And do you see yourself in those characters? Like, do they each feel like they're a part of you?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say for everything I write, you know, I pull from lived experiences. This is, you know, very similar. It's all fictionalized, but there are aspects of myself and aspects of the things that I've been through growing up here in Ohio that have made their way into the book in various forms. I do absolutely love the characters. I love Sloane and Cameron and Elliot and Anna. I do identify with all of them in different ways. They're less caricatures. I think in comics, characters can be one-dimensional sometimes or necessarily flat, you know, especially in a direct market monthly series where you only have 20 pages. Like, if your character's goofy, your character always has to be goofy to kind of hit, to make people remember and understand the character traits. Mm-hmm. And one of the benefits of getting to write a full book is the characters can be really complex and multidimensional and have, you know, aspects of themselves that are contradictory. And, you know, Sloane is both a loving friend and also a bit of a coward sometimes. And Cameron has, you know, he can be a protector, but at the same time, he can be silent and he can step back and not really do anything and just kind of let things happen. And I think all of the characters in the comic, the most important thing that I tried to pull from myself and my life is the fact that everyone that I've ever known is multidimensional in ways that are incredibly hard to articulate. And the best way sometimes to show those dimensions to a character is to make them contradictory and to make their personalities, their inner personalities and their inner self kind of clash with themselves. And I think that's, you know, the biggest thing I identify with all the characters. But yeah, I'm really proud. I love all the characters. There's a thing about the characters that I'm wondering, and there's a panel in the book. I'm wondering if anyone's going to ever mention it. I'm not going to bring it up here. I'll bring it up after the podcast, but it's super esoteric. And I don't know if anyone's going to get it, but there is a little hidden thing that I put.
Okay. Well, I'm very excited to to hear about what that is, because I definitely didn't. I don't think I caught it, but we'll find out. The other aspect of this, because I was reading a little bit about you talking about this book before, and you mentioned that you grew up in a cult, and the cult of the chorus is such a huge part of this book. Would you like to share a little bit about that experience and how that played into shaping the antagonistic force in this book?
Absolutely. So I mean, it's so hard to kind of put it in simple terms, but up until about 12, I was in what most people would call a cult. I didn't know it was a cult until, you know, later when I was a little, you know, 12 or so. I was like, this is kind of silly sounding. But it's so mundane. I think that's the biggest thing I learned about being in a cult in the United States in this, you know, 20th century, is that the kind of boringness of it, especially when you're in a cult that doesn't really, you know, there is no secret sex dungeon in the cult that I was in. There was no, you know, people weren't going missing. There was no insidious conspiracy to indoctrinate. It was just, mm-hmm. Boring white people copying New Age philosophy from India and East Asia and selling it very expensively to unassuming lower middle class people that were desperately looking for meaning. My dad and my family kind of got caught up in that, and it was. You know, as boring as it could be, I would literally equate it to the same experience of being in a Sunday school where you're not connecting or jiving with anything that's being said, but you just kind of understand that this is the way things are. And, you know, instead of pointing to a cross and saying, this is the person that I believe in, I was pointing to a picture of a guy with glasses and a bald spot who had a very normal name. And I was like, this dude's my God. He's still hanging around in Michigan or Minnesota somewhere. So, and so it's like, as I got older and I started to really disconnect from that side of growing up, it created a kind of natural curiosity about religion, but also I have a pretty big, like alarm bell that goes off whenever I kind of see those that certain mentalities that pop up in religious environments and cult environments. And I, you know, it's taken a long time for me to be able to get to a point where I can both look at a religion and say, like, I respect the fact that you believe these things, and I respect your you know, prerogative to believe whatever you want to believe. What I ultimately find it did is create a big distrust in people who are selling you things and trying to capture you as a member of their flock or their whatever it is. You know, it's not anyone's fault that they get indoctrinated. Being indoctrinated is almost like a passive. It's like radioactivity. You can walk into an area and be indoctrinated and not even know that it's happening. And it's the people that do the indoctrination that I've really started to identify and try to very much stay away from those kinds of people. So. Yeah, that's my experience. I'm sure it's very different for, like, and that's the other thing, is that there are so many cults in the United States. Like, and I'm saying cults as in like the literal, like most people's definition of what a cult would be, a very small sect of people that believe a fringe religious thing. And there's so many of them. I know of like two or three right here in Columbus that are offshoots of Christianity that hit all of those weird cult mentality, bullet points. And if you're privy to those things, like, you obviously, like, you know, you get your hackles up, you know, like, stay away from that kind of stuff. But there's so many. And not everyone's experience is the same. Mine was very mundane, very boring. We had books. And there's like a baseball book that I read about it. Obviously I can't say the name because they are one thing we all know about cults is that they are very litigious. So my experience was rather chill, like traumatic. It was still slightly traumatic for, you know, anyone being told to believe or being told this is the nature of reality. And you come to find out that, you know, that's not the nature of reality. You know, that can be traumatic. But other than that, it's left more creative inspiration than it has left trauma for me, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I like that. I think that's a great way to look at it.
Thank you.
And I love the way that you talk about it and the way that you portray it in this book as something that's unassuming. Yeah. And it feels like such a big through line of the book. It feels so unassuming until it's not, until you realize just how deep Sloane and her friends are in. And I, like, personally for me, the cult in our town was this giant Southern Baptist church that just sat in the heart of the town, like a pulsing tumor. And I remember growing up, it's weird to be in a town where everyone has a similar mindset, but you're on the outside of it. Because no one seems to understand that what they're saying feels insane.
That's the punk mindset. And I've grown up, I've loved punk music and the punk culture growing up. And that's the biggest thing that I've identified with is that, you know, if the outside, you know, that's what this is. That's what Sloane and the friends are. They're outsiders in this community. And when you're pushed to the outside, I think that you're more freely able to, you know, accommodate those punk tendencies and still be able to live and operate a life. I'm very grateful that I'm an outsider and I did not fall in line with a lot of the things that were going on when I was growing up. So, I agree.
Yeah. I'm also very, very grateful. And I just, the conclusion of this book, I can't spoil it for everyone listening, but there's something so satisfying to me about the way this book ends. Right. I saw that moment. I'm like, okay, I know exactly what that feels like. So, the course has a very real, you know, foothold in reality. It's definitely like a cult that you could see existing, but there is that supernatural element to it. Yep. The afternoon man who is definitely a terrifying monster slasher villain. Can you talk a little bit about how you turned, how you personified the chorus into this monstrous entity that is hunting Sloane and her friends in the story?
Yeah. I've always loved the work of Satoshi Kon. Perfect Blue is one of my favorite films. And I've also loved the work of David Lynch. You know, kind of abstract symbolism over narrative sometimes and vibe and tone over story. I've been criticized by a good friend of mine for that, which is fine. I get it. It's like, I know not every, you know, when you pick up a book, sometimes you want to read Dracula and other times you might want to read Finnegan's Wake, you know, and somewhere in the in-between exists someone like me who wants to kind of try and do both to various degrees of success. But for The Man in the Afternoon, I really love, and I really wanted to, and a lot of credit goes to Sam too. This was not the first iteration of this character. There's other designs of him. But this is the one we really felt personified the mood of the story. And the one thing that we really worked hard on is finding his face and what his face looks like. And I really wanted it to not be scary. His face needed to be as unassuming and kind of boring and a little off in a way that maybe is imperceptible or hard to describe. But for the most part, I think, and he, another thing I don't know if you picked up, but he appears throughout the story in multiple panels in the background and stuff. Mm-hmm. We wanted him to fit in and not be out of place and not stick out, because that's what the cult is. It is an unassuming, harmless from the outside, kind of goofy. They use silly words. They sing a silly song. It all is kind of silly. And that is, I think, on purpose. I think a lot of those cults and a lot of those institutions and a lot of those types of people utilize that aspect of the mundane and the silly and kind of nonsensical and fantastical to, in a way, cover their tracks. It's self-deprecating religiosity, if in a way. It's like, if they can get in before the jokes about how it's kind of goofy and kind of make fun of themselves and make it not, you know, it's like Scientology almost, with like, mm-hmm. you know, they've got the alien bullshit at the core of their story. And it's like, everybody knows that, but I'm sure they're still seeing people sign up for that in spite of kind of the silliness of what L. Ron Hubbard wrote. And I think the chorus does that too. And we wanted the main kind of villain of the story, the main to represent that mundane, boring. I think he wears like office clothes. Mm-hmm. He's like nothing of interest or note. Just a random guy that you might see at a grocery store line or something. And I wanted that and for those reasons, and also just as a, for me, it feels present to think about that in terms of the United States in this day and age, and kind of who is doing the hurting lately. Mm-hmm. And it felt like an accurate kind of way to look at that stuff.
Yeah. I was actually going to ask if a lot of the current political environment had a big sway in this book, but I felt that was pretty evident.
I think I tend to be pretty silent on social media for a few good reasons. Mm-hmm. I hope that my beliefs and my voice is a lot. I think it's a lot better received through the art that I create, and I think that you're absolutely right. It is suffused in the book, the political and the kind of emotional through points for a lot of things. But I generally like to keep that at the background. Mm-hmm. It's not a theme of the book, but it's definitely there. Just like in our current landscape, it's like you can talk about anything right now. And it's not necessarily about the politics or the political landscape or what you necessarily believe, but that is kind of the insidious nature of right now, is that mm-hmm. whatever you talk about is politicized or has a Ohio's a red state, so it's like you can't avoid thinking about the religious aspects of where we live and how that affects the political beliefs of certain people. So, there's a reason I think you look at our characters and kind of feel anti-established. Mm-hmm. And that's because the establishment in this book is the cult for the most part.
Oh, yeah. Do you find that's a hard balance to walk, to keep that messaging exactly where you want it in the background and not to feel like you're overdoing it? Or do you feel it fits in like really, really nicely with the plot?
I don't try to worry about it too much. You know, when I'm ever writing something, a lot of those things develop naturally in the symbols and the mm-hmm. the way that the characters interact with each other and kind of that happens as you kind of water the story. Those flowers kind of blossom up, and you get to kind of watch it in real time and see which ones you like and see which ones you don't. You know, there's absolutely a version of this story had I cultivated certain aspects of it that would have pushed it much further into a kind of a scathing, denouncing mm-hmm. tone of what all this is. But I think the mood and the vibe and the tone that I've always felt, it wasn't so much anger as it is kind of just a sad resentment that this is the way things are, and that it's either, you know, get out or die sort of, what, like, kind of, as you know, I say that as I live in Ohio, but so it's, you know, I think those things are natural, and it wasn't too difficult to find the balance, because I don't necessarily ever knew if the, I guess to answer, it's like, I was never really concerned about the balance of the book and how it felt, because I knew that the totality of the story was more important than the individual mm-hmm. pacing or beats of the story. I knew that if it's viewed as a whole, you know, hopefully when everyone finishes it, they're left with a feeling that they completed a whole thing and not left with the feeling that there are parts of the book that they didn't like, you know? Mm-hmm. I think that's the goal for every writer, is that once it closes, you want people to say, that was a fucking great book, period. That's all you want people to say. And, you know, hopefully that happens when people yeah. close this book.
I think that's really interesting, because I love hearing about, like, the difference in the industry between pushing something like a weekly monthly book versus an OGN. And the way you pace this book is definitely very, very great, because I think it really helps the theme. It's spread out, and you don't feel like you're in a rush to get to those big moments.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that was really freeing as a storyteller? Oh,
so it's so nice. I mean, you're absolutely right. When you're on a schedule of 22, 24 page issues, I'll say this. There are certain writers out there doing their stuff today that are incredible and absolutely have mastered the direct market monthly comic book. I'm not one of those people, and I've always found it very difficult to have that structure, that inherent structure, mm-hmm. and not feel like the reader goes in expecting a big thing that happens at the end of every issue. And it's hard to find a story structure for the direct market where you have, you know, I think most creator-owned comics are like 4 or 5 issues these days. So it's like you have to have 4 or 5 really shocking moments to basically have a comic book on the market right now. And Loving Ohio doesn't have that. You know, Loving Ohio, it's a little bit of a slow burn through the first 40, 60 pages. And that's 3 issues of a comic, you know. And if this were on stands, the number one sells the most, and then you have a 70 or 80% drop off for the second issue, and then mm-hmm. you have another 50% drop off for the third issue, and it just keeps going from there. So by the time you reach, you know, this is a 216 page book, so that's maybe 10 or 11 issues. By the time anyone would have ever gotten to this last issue, if this were a direct market book, your readership is percentages of a percentage of a percentage of a percentage of a percentage. Mm-hmm. And people are judging the work on the first couple issues and saying, this is a good book or this is a bad book based off of the, you know, the handful of first things that they've read. And the great thing about working in a graphic novel form is that you trust, by virtue of them buying a book, a full book, that they'll finish the full book before they make any judgments about the quality mm-hmm. of it. And I love that. That's great, because, you know, this story, the whole story is my vision. It's not just make a great first issue and then coast. It's like we set out to, like, we're going to make a really good fucking book that when you pick up and read and you put down, you feel a complete satisfaction in having done it. And the direct market doesn't, you have to be a lot more, you have to be a lot more intentional with the direct market mm-hmm. and how you pace your story to make sure you retain readership. And people like Ram V and James Tinian and Chris Condon and a lot of great writers are like really have figured out how to keep readers coming back for their serialized story. And I'm still trying to crack the code on that one.
Oh, well, no, that was awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah.
I would love to talk to Sam Beck about this book too, because I think she does an amazing job on the art.
I can absolutely hook you up with Sam's email too. So she is very available. We're trying to do our own because we have the comics industry is so fucking wacky. It's like I've got this book coming out in August, which is like my main, you know, this is my big release for the year. But I also have I love a comic that I'm doing right now at IDW with Lonnie called Golgotha Motor Mountain, which the first issue comes out next week. Mm-hmm. So it's like I got to talk about that a little bit when I can with other people. And Sam's also got her other book verse is happening too. So it's like we're juggling trying to market everything that we're doing. And that's just the comic industry. We're all writing and involved in 600 different projects at any given time. So it's,
oh yeah.
You just have to kind of pick which ones you hope are going to get the most visibility.
Yeah. And say just like this book itself, I read 6 months ago. So how long were you working on this book, you and Sam?
Whew. I think if I'm being kind to myself, I think I came up with the idea for Loving Ohio. And by idea, I mean like I had a title, which is usually one of the first things I come up with. And a couple of things. There was a whole version of this book that was a direct market book. I think there's a 22 page script sitting around somewhere in my inbox of very different characters. That was probably like 2018 when I first started really thinking about this story.
Wow.
And then it took about 2 years after that. I think Dark Horse picked it up in early 2020, maybe ish. And I spent a year writing it. Sam spent a year drawing it, and then Dark Horse spent a year kind of collecting everything and packaging it and making it a book. And now, mm-hmm. now here in 2024, we're finally getting to like talk about it and market it. And that's how long comics take sometimes. It's crazy.
It's crazy, but oh, gosh. I hope everyone out there understands. Hey, listen, this is a book that feels like it was made with care and love, and it's so going to be worth it when you get in your hands in August. Matt, that's all the questions I had for you. You've been absolutely a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for being on. Besides Loving Ohio coming out in August, do you know what day it comes out exactly?
Right now I'm being told August 6th, which is
August 6th.
I think a Tuesday. I think that's the book market day. And then August 7th is the direct market day.
Yeah. Okay. Gosh, I'm so excited. I can't wait to hold this book in my hands. It's one of those books that's so pretty. Looking at my phone, I'm like, I
haven't even seen it. I don't know what it's going to look like in print.
You haven't seen it yet?
No, they haven't printed it yet. I think it goes to print here in the next month or two. So I should have my author copies, you know, hopefully before the end of spring. But yeah, I'm so excited to see it printed and see what it looks like. Sam did the interiors are inspired by Sam has a big love for lithography and the lithograph kind of Rizzo, not lithograph.
Oh, okay.
Lithograph's totally different.
Hey, I was just gonna nod and go along with
it. Rizzo print. The colors of Rizzo printing. I was familiar. I did art and design long before I was a writer. And when Sam brought up that she wanted to utilize Rizzo printing and kind of printmaking in the design aspect of how she chose the colors and how the layouts look, and I was just blown away. It is such a gorgeous book, and I you know, more than anything, obviously I would love if everyone comes to this out of this book saying I'm a genius. But more than that, I would love if people come out of this book saying like Sam Beck is one of the best comic artists alive right now. I do believe that. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely, no problem. Mean every word. When you're not writing comics, where can people find you?
Yeah, so you can find me on social media at Matthew Ehrman. That's most places, Instagram and the other ones. I have a website, MatthewErman.com. It just has the links to the other places. And I think a few places where you can buy some of my books on Amazon or your local bookstore. Would much prefer you support your local bookstore when you're pre-ordering anything. Yeah, I'm here in Columbus, Ohio. If anyone wants to find me here, I'm sure you wouldn't have to look too far. I'm very distinct looking.
Awesome. Your hair is awesome, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah. This is one of the benefits of being a full-time dad that it, you know.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Okay. I actually changed my mind. I do have one more question before we go. Yeah. It's a very serious question. What are your thoughts on Skyline Chili?
Oh, I love Skyline. I love Skyline
Chili. Yeah. Dallas, I hope you're listening. Dallas, suck it. Everyone else is right, Dallas.
It's there's a lot of opinions, obviously, mm-hmm. but the most important opinion to know is that it is not chili. It is like a what is it? It's more like a bolognese. It's like a what's the main Cincinnati? I'm forgetting the group of people that came over and brought this fucking dish with them, but it's a very unique, specific ethnic dish from I think either Eastern Europe or South North Ukraine, Russia. But
yeah. I thought it might have been Grecian, but...
Oh, you're right. It's Grecian. I'm being a total dip. Yeah. It's like a Grecian bolognese. And that's Skyline Chili. And it's really good when you think about it like that. But if you think about it like you're going to get like a bowl of chili, then you're going to be super weird and disappointed about it. But it's so good when you go in knowing that it's something totally different. Get it with the hot dog. Get it with, you know, get it three ways. Whatever you want. But it's great.
Heck yeah.
We might have some Skyline Chili this weekend. We're watching a wrestling pay-per-view. So that might be what we're doing.
That's a great combination. And I have a friend who they live in Memphis now. And they had a friend who came up to Cincinnati and they're like, I'm going to try something. What should I try? And they were like, you should probably just try Skyline. That's something Cincinnati. And they texted my friend a few minutes later, like, this is the most disgusting thing I've ever tasted. It's like, what'd you get? And they're like, I just got a bowl of chili.
Well, there's your problem. Don't do that. You have to get it. Anyway, if you like Cincinnati, my comic that comes out next week, it'll probably be out by the time this podcast airs, but it's called Golgotha Motor Mountain. And it's about two hillbilly meth cooks from Kentucky whose meth barn gets hit with an alien asteroid, and they make a plan to sell the alien asteroid as drugs so they can make enough money to move to Cincinnati. And that's the plot. And they just want to get over the Rhine. They just want to cross the bridge to get into Cincinnati and get a better life. So if you like Cincinnati and Skyline Chili, you'll also like that comic as well.
Boom. Instant sell to all of my friends. This is perfect. Okay. Again, Matt, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate your time. Everyone, make sure you pre-order Loving Ohio out August 6th. And we will see you next time. Bye.
Awesome. Thank you so much, guys. Bye.